This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Tonight's debate is a contentious debate. It's divisive. It's controversial. But that's the point. We welcome them, and let's begin the debate.
This house believes Islam is a threat to the West.
We are being Islamized.
They tell me Islam is this, and the Quran says this, and Muslims believe this, and I say, but I don't believe any of those things.
Many of you would be surprised to see me today on this side of the chamber.
Religion conflicts with the ability of the state and of the West.
Hello, greetings. I'm your friendly neighbourhood Islamist.
The only clash is a clash of the uncivilised.
And this is the whole thing about this debate, is hypocrisy, deceit, censorship.
Via Stephen Gash, for a debate on the Islamification of Britain, myth or reality. He pulled out a few days before that. No, sorry.
Contextualize events, obviously you're going to end up with a simplistic view of what's going on in the world.
I'm sorry, my friend. We live in a free state where you can express. Do not impinge upon my freedom of expression.
I urge you to vote against Islamification.
Talking about the BNP.
Yes, we're talking about the BNP.
We have rules. Mr. Gash was informed of those rules. This is what freedom is about.
The media gives us one Islam. Inshallah, this evening you will hear about another one.
Good evening, and welcome everyone, and salam alaikum as well. Tonight's debate is a contentious debate. It's divisive, it's controversial, but that's the point. As a debating society, we owe it not only to our members, but to the broader society, to engage in topics that are controversial, yet critical. Divisive, yet relevant. You may not agree with the speakers this evening. You may not respect some of them. But at the end of the day, central to this organization is the respect for freedom of speech. So I implore you and ask you to participate, to adhere to the rules of the debate, and to argue fact for fact, argument for argument. Now let us begin. For the proposition this evening, speaking for the proposition is Mr. Stephen Gash. Mr. Gash is head of the Stop Islamization of Europe campaign. He has spoken on issues of Islam in the United Kingdom, on issues of interfaith relations, and on social issues relating to Islam within the United Kingdom and within Europe. Following him will be Robert Vanderhoff. He's a second-year history student at Christ's, who is also one of our competitive debaters. Concluding the argument will be Arash Yassik. He's a medic and a second-year student at Emmanuel College. For the opposition, the speaking will be Idris Tawfiq. Idris is a commentator, a writer, a speaker, who also holds a divinity degree from the Angelicum in Rome. He currently resides in Cairo, where he pursues commentary and commentary on the media and interfaith relations. Farah Jassat is a third-year history student from Newnham College, who's a former president of the Black Students Campaign and is currently the president of this year's Experience Islam Week. Our third speaker, Abdul Al-Andalusi, is a writer and social activist and one of the leading speakers of the Muslim Debate Initiative in the United Kingdom. Ladies and gentlemen, we welcome them, and let's begin the debate.
I'd like to thank the Cambridge Union for inviting me. It's nice to be given the opportunity for once to be able to discuss the issues and debate the issues which invariably I'm censored from doing in the British media. So I'm very grateful for this opportunity. The first thing we do have to do is define what we mean by the West exactly. Well, the West can be summed up in one word, I would suggest, and that word is democracy. With all its nuances and imperfections, all Western countries have adopted democracy as a way of empowering people to voice their concerns and to vote in and out their leaders. Some say we have a liberal democracy. Well, I'm reluctant to use such a term because, in my experience, self-styled liberals have a list as long as your tax bill of all the things they want to ban. And unfortunately, one of the things they wish to ban is free speech.
Mr. Bagash, can you just speak up a bit?
Speak up a bit?
Yes, yeah. Thanks.
I'm sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Well, we have these democracies, and it's a very fragile thing. I remind people, if you need reminding, that people have been only able to vote in this country, men and women, for less than 100 years. Some countries longer, some less. And only this week we're debating in Parliament whether prisoners should at long last get the right to vote. Islam is the very antithesis of democracy. It is a despotic, theocratic doctrine which oppresses its people. All over the world, this is the truth. And if we look at the West, there's not a single country that is blissfully free of Islam. But there's one country in the world which only has Islam as its religion, and that is the seat of Sunni Islam, Saudi Arabia. You know, we have signs in Saudi Arabia saying, Muslims this way, non-Muslims that way. And that is what the world is gravitating to. Certainly, the 57 Muslim countries in the world are gravitating towards either the Shia form of Islam as practiced in Iran, or Sunni Islam as practiced in Saudi Arabia. Not one of those 57 Islamic countries has signed the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, preferring instead their own Cairo Declaration, which enshrines Sharia law. Sharia law in itself is divisive. It deliberately undermines the status of non-Muslims. It gives them the term kafar. They don't have the rights that Muslims have. And this is enshrined in all of the Islamic texts, from the Quran to the Hadith. Non-Muslims have a lower class status. Now, I don't know about you, but I think that non-Muslims have a right, certainly in non-Muslim countries, to a class where they can determine what's good for them, what's right for them, what's right for their country. And the thing about democracy is we can change these values. You may believe in capital punishment. You may even believe that people should be beheaded. But that is the will of the people. It is not the immutable word of some dodgy deity. And that's the difference. You know, we can change things. We can decide how we want our countries to be. We can form alliances, we can break alliances, we vote in our leaders, we vote them out. That is not the case in Islamic countries. Certainly some have the appearance of democracies. But in every single Islamic country, non-Muslims are being oppressed. And this oppression is not being reported in the Western media. I'll give you a good example. In Egypt, only a year ago, 330,000 pigs, a third of a million pigs, were slaughtered barbarically by being buried alive, beaten to death, or dropped in acid baths. A third of a million pigs. Under the smokescreen of eradicating swine flu. No other country saw fit to do that. Certainly we had pigs slaughtered in the West to combat the disease. But in Egypt, the sole reason for that barbaric slaughter of a third of a million pigs was just to finish the point, was to starve out the Coptic Christians who are being persecuted in a genocidal fashion in Egypt. Coptic Christian girls in Egypt are being raped at the age of 13, abducted, forcibly converted to Islam and marrying Muslim men. That's not only happening in Egypt, it's happening in Malaysia.
For your information, what do you think about Boutros Ghali, who was the secretary?
This debate is about the threat of Islam to the West, not what's going on.
Yeah, no, it is. That is a threat. I'm making the point. Okay. I'm making the point, with all due respect, of where we are now, democratic countries, and what's happening in the rest of the world. Yeah, and that's where we're being dragged to. My organisation is Stop Islamisation of Europe. Yeah, we are being Islamised. While our troops are being bombing democracy into Muslim countries such as Afghanistan and Iraq, we're instilling Sharia law in our own country. I had a demonstration on September the 11th outside Harrow Mosque where we were confronted by 2,000 Muslims last year. We hold a demonstration every September the 11th, okay? And we're told that's confrontational. The reason we choose September the 11th is because of the Twin Towers, you know, the disaster. But the reason Al-Qaeda chose that date, September the 11th, is because on that date in 1683, the Muslim hordes were thrown back from the gates of Vienna. So Islamic rule was prevented on September the 11th all those years ago. And it sticks in the craw of Muslims all over the world that Europe is not now an Islamic state. In Harrow, you know, we were vilified for doing these demonstrations. We actually got chased out on September the 11th, so we held it again on December the 13th that year. What's happened in Harrow is the councillors who opposed us are now forcibly feeding school children halal slaughtered food. So the Islamisation of these children is taking place without their parents' knowledge. It's just been exposed this year. There's a bit of a debate going on in Harrow as to whether that's the case. It may interest people to know that in Denmark, every piece of poultry sold in supermarkets, apart from a tiny proportion of organic produce, is halal slaughtered. People are being force-fed this produce deceitfully.
You appear to be conflating cultural integration and Islamization simply because a society, as we are a democracy, we decide to accept the values of other people that decide to come to our country. We accept them. This isn't necessarily some sort of Islamization. These are the foundations of democracy.
No, not at all. No. Rubbish. The whole foundation of democracy is choice. This choice is being removed from the people who are being force-fed this food because they don't even know they're eating it. New Zealand lamb, for example. They don't even know it's halal slaughtered. Whether they're agnostic, and I make one point as well, you know, our biggest critics in Harrow were the Jewish councillors. But their children are not being force-fed halal food. It's all about choice. This is what I'm debating. I have no problem with people eating halal food, although I'm a vegetarian myself. because if they have the choice. That's what the whole thing is about. And let me just make this point.
For your permission?
I want to make this point. It's I've got 2 minutes remaining. Turkey, okay? People are clamouring to get Turkey into the EU. We went to war against Saddam Hussein for using chemical weapons against the Kurdish people. Okay, Tony Blair made a big thing about this, so it was the right thing to do because Kurds were killed by chemical weapons. Turkey used chemical weapons, reportedly, against those self-same Kurdish people, and we're clamouring to get 70 million Muslims into our European Union. And this is the whole thing about this debate. It's hypocrisy, deceit, censorship, ridicule, and the facts aren't there. My organisation would not exist if the British media and the Western media did their jobs and reported things impartially, instead of going time after time after Israel for what's happening in the Gaza Strip, misreporting things like that, the supposed killing of Mohammed Al-Jura, the 12-year-old boy, against a wall, sheltering behind his father. It was complete fabrication, thrown out of a French court. No redaction, no retraction by the media. If the media did their job properly, I would not need to stand here now debating the issue. In fact, none of us would need to be here because you would all agree with me.
Speakers, it is purely within your choice to accept points of information.
Am I allowed to ask questions?
So when you're speaking, again, if you need to make a point, please do. But at the same time, if someone raises a point of information, please also feel open to take their question. All right? Mr. Idris Tawfiq, you have the floor.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, most gracious, most compassionate. Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen. All praise be to Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Wa salat wa salam ala ashraf al-mursaleen, Sayyidina Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon his final messenger Muhammad. Wa salamu alaykum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And may the peace and the blessings and the mercy of Almighty God be upon all of you here today. You honour me by inviting me to this place, and you honour me by coming and listening to this debate about Islam. I had hoped, Mr. Vice President, I had hoped to have been invited last year to speak in a debate you had last year, that this House believes there's more to this life than being really, really ridiculously good-looking. But unfortunately, you didn't invite me. You asked Peter Stringfellow to come and talk. That's the story of my life, really. So I want to talk to you instead. In these few minutes I have to speak, I want to speak about another beauty. I want to speak to you about the beauty of Islam. I've come from Egypt. And with the greatest respect to my honourable opponent, the Egypt he speaks of is not an Egypt I know. And I didn't want to interrupt, but just as a point of information, we'll call it the pig episode. The pigs were slaughtered in Egypt because His Holiness Pope Shenouda III requested of the Egyptian government that they be killed. Now, I want to talk to you today. Some people talk about a clash of civilizations. A clash, Islam being a threat to the West. I believe, and Muslims believe, that there's no clash of civilizations. The only clash is a clash of the uncivilized. The only clash is between ignorant people shouting at each other. who don't take the time to listen to what the other has to say. And it's on both sides. There are Muslims who shout and don't listen. And there are people in the West who shout and don't listen. But Islam is at home in every culture and in every civilization. Terrorism may be a threat to the West. And it is. It's a scourge. And I travelled on a plane myself from Cairo and was very aware when I was being checked that terrorism is indeed a threat. Some people would perceive immigration as a threat to the West, as hordes of people travel from foreign lands, and we see people with foreign-looking faces and different lifestyles. That may be perceived as a threat to the West. In Switzerland, quiet little Switzerland, famous for clocks and chocolate and cowbells and banking. The people of Switzerland were frightened. They were made to be frightened about Islam because the people very cleverly chose to link Islam with hordes of people who were coming over the mountains at dead of night with their suitcases and their children following them, without jobs or visas. And I said to the Swiss ambassador in Cairo, I said, sir, if you have a problem with immigration, sort it out. But Islam isn't the problem. Islam is not a threat to anyone. I want just to tell you what Islam is. Because I hear many people telling me what I believe as a Muslim. They tell me Islam is this, and the Quran says this, and Muslims believe this, and I say, but I don't believe any of those things. You know, we see on the television very terrible things happening, and we condemn them, absolutely.
On that point, sir.
Please.
So, you did a nice bit of quoting at the beginning of your speech, and I'm sure you've heard many people come to you with things like the verse of the sword, and chapter 9, verse 29, which say things like, slay the non-believers wherever you find them, and do so until they pay tax, and they should be humbled by this. And all I say to you is that you may be a peaceful man, and you may call yourself a Muslim, but have you not considered that perhaps you're just not practicing Islam as it's meant to be practiced?
Thank you very much for that point. I was waiting for that one. Listen to this quotation. Their children shall be dashed to pieces before their eyes, their houses spoiled and their wives raped. Dash the young men to pieces.
On that point, sir.
Have no pity. Have no pity. Have no pity. Have no pity on the fruit of the womb. The children shall not be spared. Isaiah chapter 13.
Point of information.
No, I want to finish my point, please. I'm in the middle of a point. I used to be a Roman Catholic priest, and I have the greatest respect for the teaching of Christianity and the teaching of Judaism. The greatest, deepest respect. After tomorrow, I will meet Archbishop Gregorios of Thyatira in Great Britain in London. And I'll go to hit the head of the Greek Orthodox Church and I'll say to him, sir, I come to present the good wishes and respect of the Muslim community to your eminence and to the Church of Thyatira. My work, and the work of all the Muslims I work with, is to travel the world as ambassadors of Islam. Now, I know the Bible like the back of my hand, and I know what I just read is no more typical of the Bible than I'm the man in the moon. That message there is not the message of Christianity, nor is it the message of Judaism.
Point of information.
And people, I'm in the middle of one, sorry. And people are quoting things at me. You know, when I was training for the priesthood, one of my teachers said, the devil can quote scripture. You can take anything from anywhere, in any scripture. And you can even take 10 quotations or 20. I've got 20 there. And you can sum the religion up by the, but this is wrong. Please.
There are 15 million Jews in the world for various reasons. We know one of them. Well, one of them is being persecuted over the centuries. The second reason is Judaism, regardless of what it says in the Old Testament, is not a proselytizing religion. It's very difficult to become a Jew. And unlike Islam, where Muslims have spread their faith at the point of the sword across much of the face of the world, which is why there is a billion of them, there's a big difference between a non-proselytizing religion like Judaism and one where it's been enforced upon people at the point of the sword, as is happening now. 3.3 million Christians have been murdered in Sudan in my lifetime by Muslims purely for being Christian.
Last year, I met... Thank you for that point. Last year, I met in Istanbul the chief rabbi of Turkey. I visited first the Patriarch of Constantinople. And I said to him, "Sir, you honour me and you honour all Muslims by seeing me today. And I've come to present the good wishes of all Muslims, as I did to the mayor of Cambridge this afternoon." And she gave me a Jew. And she gave me this lapel pin. And I said, "I'll wear it tonight at the debate in honour of my meeting with you." And after meeting the Patriarch in Constantinople, I met the chief rabbi of Turkey. The chief rabbi of Turkey carries the title Haham Basha. Haham Basha is a title that was given to the leader of the Jewish community in 1453 by Sultan Mehmet II. The Jews had fled from Catholic Spain, fled for their lives, where they were being turned out of their synagogues, and they fled to the Ottoman Empire. And the leader of the Jews in the Ottoman Empire in 1453 was given the title Haham Basha, chief wise man of the Ottoman Empire, as the patriarch was given the title leader of the Orthodox peoples. Let me just brief, please, I've not got much time. So what I want to do is just say, you hear a lot of nonsense. Forgive me for calling it nonsense. You hear a lot of nonsense talked on the TV about Islam. I hear it and say, what are they saying? Islam isn't like this, isn't Islam? What are they talking about? Islam is very, very simple. I will sum up for you what Islam teaches. And all else is helping people to live out that teaching. Islam teaches two things. One, there is a God. As Muslims, we say, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah. I bear witness that there is one God. And that's the first point, there is a God. And the second point, Islam teaches that that God speaks to his creation. As Muslims, we say, Wa ashhadu anna Muhammad a Rasulallah. And I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. But as Muslims, we could also say, I bear witness that there's no God but the one God in heaven. And I bear witness that Moses is the messenger of Allah. We could say, I bear witness that there's no God but Allah, and I bear witness that Jesus is the messenger of Allah. My dear friends, Islam is not a threat. Muslims believe... I'm sorry, I only have a minute or 1 minute left, so I can't. I'm sorry. Muslims believe that Islam has existed since the beginning of time. They believe it to be the natural religion of mankind. And we hope to show as a team, inshallah, God willing, that Islam, like all religions, respects the beliefs of others. Islam, I tell Muslims all over the world when I travel to speak to them, this is the century of Islam in the West. It's the century of Islam in the West because Muslims in the West can teach the rest of the Muslim world about values that have been lost, but that are fundamentally Islamic. Muslims that have been brought up in New York and London and Australia and France and Italy can teach Muslims in the world about democracy and about the high importance of education for women and about so many things we hear on the TV are un-Islamic. The media gives us one Islam. Inshallah, this evening you will hear about another one. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Gentlemen, Robert Van Hoff for the proposition.
Ladies and gentlemen, as we heard from the Vice President, this is an issue which is particularly contentious, particularly provocative, and particularly polemical. And what we heard from Stephen was a case whereby Islam is entirely alien to Western values of democracy. But what I want to try and do for you today, ladies and gentlemen, is present a moderate framework in which we might support the motion. Present a framework which opposes Islam not by its very nature, but by its nature as a religion. A framework which sees religion as a threat to a secular West. And in that sense is able to erect a framework which is not specifically Islamophobic and is not the uncivilized discourse that we heard from First Opposition, but which is generally moderate and logical. So what I want to do for you today is reconceptualise the nature of the West as it was offered to us by Stephen. Now, what Stephen told us was that the West is about democracy. Well, I think that's true, but I think the West is actually about something deeper. And that deeper thing is secularism. So what I want to do for you today is look at exactly where those values come from. I think more important than the political consensus is the ideological consensus which underlies Western values. Now, it's quite hard to pin down what exactly we mean by those values. We're looking at a West in which the UK has a head of state who is simultaneously the head of the church, in which the Prime Minister can appoint bishops, which contrasts very deeply with a secular branch which consistently has implemented secular measures. And equally, working in a UK committed to socialist welfare development, which contrasts again very sharply with a US which is very much anti-healthcare reforms as we see today. So we see the West is quite difficult to pin down. But what we do think is that ultimately what separates Western values from values which we might construct as their opposite, so for example from medieval values, is a belief in rationality. And where we think that rationality comes from, where we think Western values, what they have at their heart, is the Enlightenment. Now, there is a problem with the Enlightenment as a concept, which is that it is pluralist. Historians have continuously rejected the nature that the Enlightenment has any kind of unity as a body of content. That is to say, that while there are Enlightenment thinkers who endorse values like democracy and secularism, there are equally Enlightenment figures like Pierre Bayle who are devout Huguenots. But we do say that the Enlightenment has a methodological unity. And what that methodological unity consists of is a consistent and universal application of sceptical doubt to all facets of life. Critically, ladies and gentlemen, this application of doubt is incompatible with religious beliefs. Because we say what religion is about, at some level, is about faith. And about an acceptance and about an obedience to certain religious authorities, whether they be Talmudic or whether they be the Quran. No, thanks. And we say, on those grounds, there is a very clear clash between a Western secular morality, which seeks to question everything, and which seeks to impugn every concept, including morality, and a religious morality, which, or even a religious set of values, which is accepting and based upon faith. Now we say, no thanks, we say that kind of secular morality is conducive to democracy, which is why, as Stephen told you, we do see a steady pattern of democratic values throughout the West. But that's simply because we value democracy as an instrumental, and because a secular morality allows us to evaluate its relative merits. And we say democracies can only emerge in a context whereby the questioning of religious authorities has allowed us to remove states who depend upon monarchs who depend on divine rights, and to remove theologians. And that's only possible when we begin to apply this enlightened, secular and critical morality. So, no thanks. So we say that it's quite clear that despite its diversity and despite the diversity of the Enlightenment, we do have a solid value system which underpins what we believe today and what we do today. And that value system is secularism. And by secularism, I mean the consistent questioning of any principle. And that's secular because religion cannot exist in an environment in which everything is continually questioned because it is predicated on faith. Yes?
Great. If your whole analysis is that democracy and secularism can't exist side by side, can you please explain why religion exists?
Okay, no. My analysis is not that democracy and secularism cannot exist side by side. That's a misrepresentation. I'm saying democracy logically follows from a secular environment, not the opposite. But what I am saying is that religion is untenable in a purely secular environment. Why? Because religious people will inevitably face conflicts between a secular Western value system, which seeks to question everything, including their religious beliefs, and their own religious beliefs, which in some sense are authoritative and non-violable. So for that reason, we see very clear conflicts between the attempt of the state to legislate on issues which have a religious signification. So, for example, to legislate on issues of abortion, to legislate on issues of education, to legislate on issues of capital punishment. These are issues which, in effect, which have religious signification to people. Religious people are therefore forced into a conflict between religious values and secular Western values. And ultimately, where religious individuals have resisted this, as they must do if they are to follow their religious imperatives, they have undermined and challenged the secularizing imperative of the West. So we say, given that the West is committed to secularism, given that religion and Islam in particular, or not in particular, but given that Islam has as a religion is opposed to secularism definitionally, and given that the West has a secularizing imperative, I'll take a minute. Religion conflicts with the ability of the state and of the West to fulfill that secularizing ability. We say religious individuals have inevitably, throughout their existence under the state, undermined the state's ability to enact secular legislation. And we say that is a continual and repetitive challenge. And we say in that sense, Islam threatens the West as a secular entity by virtue of challenging and undermining its ability to implement secular measures. Yeah.
I'm kind of confused by the point how Islam and secularism can't be together. You said that the Enlightenment is based on secularism, but it was Islam that bridged the gap between philosophy and the Enlightenment, with philosophy like Evan Seven, Al-Farabi. And okay. In fact, I think Christianity is an important part of Islam, and I know I've
got some
aspects of my faith, so I don't
understand. Yeah, no, sure. Right, that's no. What I'm not saying is that religion is necessarily, in every case, authoritative. What I am saying is that religion involves faith. Faith involves... No, thanks. Faith, definitionally, I think it would be fair to say that religion involves a faith in some kind of deity. And that was certainly the kind of idea of Islam that was given to us by first opposition. But I say, given that, faith is not the universal application of a criticising value system. Faith does not consist of impugning and problematising every value. But quite by contrast, it involves acceptance. I say, in that case, when you believe things on the basis of faith, then there is a conflict with a Western system which does not believe anything on faith, but which believes things merely on the grounds of their logical viability. That is, which is willing to question any concept and accepts concepts on the basis that they can be accepted following logical analysis, not on the basis of faith. There is a clear clash of value systems here, right? And that clash is played out in everyday society. When religious people, no thanks, try and resist the secularising imperatives of the state. And in that sense, they threaten the ability of the state to enact its values and the ability of the West to function fully as a system. Go on.
I was going to students where every college has a chapel. Could you say that your education is incompatible with enlightenment?
Okay, yeah, here is a quite clear point. Yes, so in some sense, right, the UK is not a secular country, right? I told you at the start, right, that... I told you at the start that our head of state is simultaneously the head of the church. But why is it not a secular country, ladies and gentlemen? Well, I say because the secularising project, which is inherent to the West, has not been properly fulfilled. Therefore, it remains and not a secular state. It has not fulfilled the mission which its values push it to do so. No thanks. In that sense, the reason that the West is not, the reason that the UK in particular is not secular, is because it is threatened. It is imperfect in terms of its value system because it has been threatened by religion. Now, in saying that, I don't mean to suggest that in any sense secularism is desirable, no thanks, or that religion is undesirable. Like, I think religion gives us lots of things, and I think secularism isn't necessarily the most desirable system. You might accuse it of a lack of, for example, moral firmity. However, I do think that if we strip the motion of its value-laden sense, and if we conceive of the West, as we must do, as a value system predicated on Enlightenment secular norms, and if we conceive of Islam as a non-secular system, yeah, I know, and therefore, if we conceive of the West as a society which has not properly fulfilled its secularising imperative, given that it is not secularising in reality, although it is secular in values, then we must conclude that the reason that the West has failed to carry through its secularising project is because of religious opposition, is because religions have continued to threaten the ability of the West to enact secular legislation. Islam is a religion. Islam, in that sense, is no different. Islam, it challenges our ability to implement the values that the secular values that are fundamental to Western civilization. Whether or not we regard that as a good thing, it definitely and undeniably constitutes a threat, and for that reason I stand on proposition.
Gentlemen, this has been a really interesting debate so far, particularly on the proposition bench, because we interestingly heard a complete dichotomy between the first and second speakers. I thought we were supposed to have unity on a side, but obviously this is a controversial debate on all levels. So I'll integrate my rebuttal during my points. I'm going to start off by talking about the actual framework of this debate. The second speaker tried to define what the West is, I think, in my opinion, a lot more pertinently than the first speaker. Albeit I see flaws in his definition, he defined it as basically being a secularist society, whereas the first speaker defined it as being democracy. But the West is a lot broader than that. What is the West? I think that this debate, I mean, the Union, forgive me for saying it, is very sensationalist in some of its titles. And the title, This House Believes Islam is a Threat to the West. We just need to take a step back. What is Islam, first of all? Idris Tawfiq did try and explain the core beliefs of the religion. But Islam is not a monolithic entity. Islam has been around for 1,400 years. It has a massive divide within its religious theology. You have Sunnis and Shias. Within 80%, roughly, of the Muslim population, which is Sunni, you have then four major legal schools of thought. Within that, you have lots of different sects. My point is that there's no single archetype to define what Islam is. And this variety and diversity is very important to bear in mind when we come onto points such as terrorism and the accusation of what Islam, the religion, the ideology, in fact, the civilizations that it spurted, have gone on to do. So, Islam is a threat to the West, right? I think that the threat in terms of terrorism, because let's face it, that's what's on everyone's mind, right? In terms of terrorism, the threat to the West and to all people, not just to Western people, is extremism in all of its forms and all of its political persuasions. And every single ideology, be it capitalism, be it communism, be it Islam, be it Christianity, has the potential to have political extremist fringes within that ideology. Does that make the ideology inherently extreme, inherently violent? No, it doesn't. It means that people can interpret things as extremists. In Europe, in the last 70 years, what, we've seen extreme nationalism in the form of fascism. We saw it under the Nazis. We saw it in Spain under Franco. We saw it under Mussolini. Does that mean nationalism within itself as a concept is inherently bad? No, it means an extreme interpretation of what nationalism is wrong. Similarly, we saw that with communism under Stalin and the millions of people of the extreme left that were killed under such an ideology. So let's look at the reality on the ground today. There's a very interesting statistic. I'm not a stat person, right? But Europol, which is the EU's criminal intelligence and law enforcement agency, has this on their website, a very obviously reputable organisation since it's the EU's criminal intelligence agency. In 2006, there were 498 terrorist failed, foiled or successful attacks in the whole of the EU. Thank God most of them didn't happen, yeah? Failed or foiled. 498 of them. 495 of these attacks, according to Europol, were by separatist, left-wing, right-wing, or single-issue terrorists, with only three being by Islamists. In 2007, there were 583 of these sorts of attacks, failed, foiled, or successful. Only four were pertaining to Islamists out of 583. And in 2008, there were 515 in the whole of the EU, and one was pertaining to Islamism. Extremism is the real threat to Europe and to people. And extremism can be taken from any sort of political ideology. No, thank you. No, thanks. So, the accusation that is Islam inherently extreme? I would say that no. Mainstream Islam, if you look at all the mainstream scholars of today, would absolutely, abhorrently condemn extremism, condemn terrorism. Why would you? In Islam, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, I'll take you in a moment, that to kill one person is as if you've killed the whole of mankind. And to save a person's life is as if you have saved the whole life of mankind. And that is the spirit within mainstream Islam, which extremists seek to take and pervert for their own political ends. Go for it.
Right. First of all, half the mosques in England are reportedly, have been reported as being what we would call radicalised. If the Taliban and Al-Qaeda profess such a perverse form of Islam, as you Wahhabis believe, why aren't the 1 billion Muslims or more fighting themselves? Why aren't Saudi Arabian troops, Indonesian troops, Libyan troops, Syrian troops in Afghanistan and Iraq fighting the Taliban?
Thank you. I don't have time to take it, so you'll have to sit down now.
Well, about
great, because in Afghanistan, right, it's such a liberating war, isn't it? Because we all believe the reasoning behind the invasion of Afghanistan, and definitely we would have all been troops there if we, like, you know, really agreed with it. That's an utterly perverted point. Okay, radicalization in mosques, right? Okay, what is radicalization? Are all forms of what we call radicalization violent? Because I have never met in my life, and I'm an active member of the Islamic community, both in Cambridge and back home in Leicester, I have never met in my life a violent extremist. I've met people that people would call extremists because, yeah, they disagree very strongly with Western foreign policy. Maybe they think in Muslim countries there should be Islamic states. They don't believe in the UK or in the West there should be Sharia law. By the way, I'll come on to that later. I have never met someone that wants Sharia law in the UK, so I don't know where that comes from. No, thank you. The definition of radicalization really needs to be looked at, because this word is sensationalist. It's bunged around by the media as if it always means the same thing. The threat to the West would be violent extremism, right, in terms of this sort of radicalization. And I fundamentally do not believe most Muslims are like that. And even if some people are, that is not the message of Islam. The message of Islam, as mainstream Islamic scholars and people believe, is that of peace. And yeah, so it may sound cliche, but most Muslims, you know, don't believe that, because if they were, we'd all be terrorists, right? No, thanks. Well, I'm running out of time. So, what's really interesting, actually, since, you know, you may not believe me, because obviously, you know, I'm Muslim and I'm going to be biased, right? Let's look at what MI5 has to say. There was an MI5 report that was circulated in June to the intelligence agency. It was a research paper written by the Behavioural Science Unit, and it was called Understanding Radicalisation and Violent Extremism in the UK, right up your street, right? So, their conclusion was that there is no single pathway to violent extremism. Obviously, as Cambridge students, we probably think that, and it's a bit too simplistic to think there's one way to extremism. But what was very interesting and surprising about the report when it was circulated in June was that they concluded that actually fundamentalism and religious zeal is not the driving factor of those involved in terrorism. In fact, most of the case studies they looked at, the people that are associated with terrorism do not practice their faith regularly. A lot of them do drugs, they drink alcohol, and they visit prostitutes, which, if you don't know, is against the mainstream beliefs of Islam. And there are a lot of religious converts, which the report describes as religious novices. It actually says people lack religious literacy. And MI5's report goes far enough to say that actually Islam, the religion, serves to prevent and protect against such a threat. Because the pathways to extremism are a lot to do with migration, marginalization, and racism in society, and religious naivety. I urge the whole proposition to actually go and look at that report and the findings of it, because this is an objective, come on, our intelligence agency, and they're saying that it's not Islam, it's not the religion that causes that to happen. Okay, I'm running out of time. No, thank you. I can't take any more points. I'm running out of time. Right. Yeah, I know I'm running out of time. Thanks. So, let me do a bit of rebuttal and get down to some of these points. Okay, right. The pig episode in Egypt. Okay, so that happened, right? I think it's ridiculous that happened. That's not Islam. Okay, moving on. So, all of these assertions about people getting raped and, like, conversions and all this sort of stuff. Right, ladies and gentlemen, the practices of what happened in Muslim Islamic countries, by the way, I don't think there's any sort of Islamic country in the world today, is not the teachings of Islam, the teachings of people, cultural practices, if you're saying that, you know, like, democracy is inimical with Islam, if we look at the Muslim countries around the world today, products reeling from the colonialist era, Iraq, Hashemite monarchy was, I'm a historian, sorry, Hashemite monarchy was, like, propped up there. Then they went, this is reeling from, like, the Ottoman Empire. And then, you know, Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party, there was a coup. All this stuff is going on in the Muslim countries. There's not this, like, dichotomy between Islam and democracy. Look at the context of these places, ladies and gentlemen. If you don't contextualize events, obviously you're going to end up with a simplistic view of what's going on in the world. So, yeah, halal food. People are forced... No, I'm running out of time. People are forced to have halal food. Yeah, because someone's standing with a gun to their head. Right, in terms of... In terms of the secularism point, I'm just going to say, because I'm running out of time, liberalist democracy, I thought that meant government by the people, for the people, of the people. And if the people so wish to have some sort of morality that's based in religion, then let them have it, because democracy is about what the people want. It's not fundamentally secular in all of its views. No, thank you, I'm running out of time, as we all know. Now, I'd just like to say that Islam is not a new phenomenon, ladies and gentlemen. It was not created in 2001 with September 11th. It's gone back 1,400 years. And we have to understand it as a civilizational, as a civilization. It interacted at the centers of civilization in places like Spain. Moorish Spain, as the girl already mentioned, produced some of the... It produced Avicenna, which produced the canon of medicine, which was used as one of the like biggest books in medicine until the early 19th century. We can see an intellectual exchange, the translation movement on 9th century Baghdad, which was when the works of Aristotle, Hippocrates, Plato was translating into Arabic. It was only those translations into Arabic which the Europeans then used in the Enlightenment to they used the Arabic translations to translate into Latin. So basically, like, Islamic civilization is not against the transfer of knowledge. Let's look at history and look at what Islam has given to the world as a civilization, understanding it as a religion, and not take it to be the fundamental interpretation of extremists, but look at it as a religion in and of itself. Thank you very much.
At this point in the debate, we open up the floor to speeches in proposition, in opposition, and in abstention. May I have a speech for the proposition, please? Okay, I'm going to start with you back there. Name and college, please.
Now I'm going to say two things which are gross generalizations. One, Islam is a religion. Two, all Muslims are human beings. Everyone should be terrified. Now, we were born 80 years ago, I might be banging on about the role of Buddhism and supporting Japanese fascism, but these days I visit the nation's universe in Tanzania and I find that people I know from my childhood being bullied by some thugs, and I hear of people being murdered in Sudan by about 2 million Christians, and all just like 400,000 black Muslims, massacred by Arab Muslims, and then I look at East Timor, and so on and so forth. So, what everyone seems to agree are these two things. Islam is a religion, all Muslims are human beings, we all know what that can mean. Please take that into account. And for goodness sakes, do not pretend that it can mean anything other than bad news. Our civilization is founded, we spent a ridiculous amount of time getting free of religion founded by oppressors. Goodness knows what it's going to take to get rid of, get ourselves free of religion founded by one. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's Mohammed Rushtarez, he's old. And we just heard a lot of ignorance. A lot of ignorance. Yes. From what I would actually just want to say, Avicenna is Persian, he's not from Spain. One other thing is that in Egypt, do you know Boutros Ghali, the Secretary General of the United Nations, who was a foreign Secretary of Affairs in Egypt, was Christian? You know that the richest man in Egypt, Nadif Zawiri, is Christian? He made his first fortune in Libya, which is another Islamic country. Another thing, could you cite me, please, one Arabic country that applies Sharia apart from Saudi Arabia? There is no one. By the way, guys, I can pay you a striptease in Turkey. In Turkey, there is a porn industry, which is legal. One thing, I think we're fair enough because he didn't accuse us of causing global warming because we ate spicy food and we were suggesting misleading arguments and ignorance of facts. One other thing, why there is Torres of Mada's name? Why? Okay, because my ancestors, they were chased from the Moorish Spain in the second wave, 1609. Actually, when they came back to Morocco, back then, they were Catholics, they weren't even Muslims, but they were accused of hiding, being, like, practicing Islam secretly. Well, after that, they converted to Islam again, etc. So, let us pick this example, the example of the Spanish, of the Moorish Spain. In the capital, okay, So, the capital of that state was Cordoba, the Muslim author was a Caliph back then. His prime minister was a Jew. We know him because of his correspondence with some other Jewish nation in Ukraine, the Khazar people, who were converted to Judaism, so Judaism don't proselytize. This is another fact. Okay,
such as Egypt or Saudi Arabia, are countries which Western governments and Western powers are supporting and are some of the most brutal dictatorships around this world. And actually, the fact of the matter is, on the grassroots in a lot of those countries, for example, even in Turkey and the secularism that took place there, and the way that they were able to suppress freedom of speech and freedom of practice of religion, and actually secularism wasn't the separation of religion and state. Actually, it was the suppression of people's genuine freedom of expression and thought. And it wasn't just taking place for people from religious backgrounds, it was taking place for people with any ideology which was different to the status quo. And Western powers were more than happy to accept this happening. Now, should we actually have a discussion, should we propose that the House believes that the West is a threat to the rest of the world? Because actually that might be a more legitimate question.
Because we commonly labour under the belief that phobia means fear. But it doesn't mean fear. Claustrophobia doesn't mean the fear of confined spaces. It means the irrational fear of confined spaces. If you get into a lift and you start hyperventilating, you suffer from claustrophobia. If you're buried alive and only have 30 seconds worth of oxygen left to survive, the fear that you're experiencing is entirely rational. It's sane. It's sensible. It might even give you enough energy to survive. We often hear this idea of Islam having two sides, a very liberal, open, and spiritual side. And then certain verses like verses in the Bible, that can be twisted and used as justification for terrorism. And when Idris quoted the Old Testament and revealed that the Old Testament had violent verses, you applauded him. And shame on you for doing so. Because the point is that he completely dodged the point. The point is, no one uses verses from the Old Testament today to justify their violence. And had Idris chosen to begin his speech by quoting directly from the ninth surah of the Quran, rather than the first surah of the Quran, we'd understand why that was. Ladies and gentlemen, if you just take a survey of how many wars there are in the world today, major conflicts, there are 25. If you remove all those that involve Islam in some way, you are left with 4. Does this say something about Islam? And perhaps we should really be asking the question on the order paper, does Islam threaten the West? Finishing. And it depends what kind of West you want. When I go down the street and I see a woman wearing a burqa, it discomforts me. It discomforts me not because I'm some sort of insane fool. It discomforts me because it challenges what I think the West should be. It discomforts me that when I see it, I hear the sound of Emmeline Pankhurst turning in her grave. We have a decision to make. What kind of Europe do you want? And if you want to know whether Islam is a threat, then read the books yourself and come to your own conclusion. And do not let people who represent the minority of Islam, with respect, from influencing you unduly. I beg to propose the motion.
Already knew, in that, you know, Islamic fundamentalism is a threat to the West. Islam is not a threat to the West. We've then had the proposition with, you know, really an impossible task, given I think that most people in the chamber would have come with the explicit intention of voting against, regardless of what has been said by the proposition. So we've had the second speaker give really quite a good attempt at answering the question in a sort of sane and, you know, with a decent framework. Then had the rather unfortunately named Mr. Gash give Yeah, I really don't believe that whatever the proposition had said would make any difference whatsoever. That's why I urge you all to abstain.
I think it's important to actually bring some fairly neutral neutral approach to the history of this and to see where that takes us. I think it's about the 800s. The Muslim world ran out of room in the Middle East. They've conquered it all. Partly by military conquest, and partly by the slightly less violent approach of just moving into the bits that were debatable land, taking it over, and announcing that there was a whacking great tax on everybody who wasn't a Muslim. But they ran out of room there, so they invaded Spain, and it took them a few hundred years to digest Spain, and then they got beaten. They got very badly beaten in France at Tours by Charlemagne. Charlemagne then a variety of campaigns to push them out. But to be honest, that was a very, very long time ago, so I think judging Islam by that would be a little unfair. But I think it's also important to judge Islam by things that it's done slightly more recently. When the Ottoman Empire accepted these Jews, which we talked about last time, it's important to realise why they accepted them. These are Jews from Jewish families that were rather like the Rothschilds, And to be honest, the Rothschilds were running away from Britain. Who wouldn't take them and their several billion to fund your extravagant lifestyle? The history to try and prove a point. Bear in mind that these Jews also went to a severe Protestant Amsterdam for the same reason, is that they were being, is that they brought their money with them. And the Catholic Spain only chucked them out because they had the money, they had the silver coming in from South America, so they didn't need the Jews' money anymore. And nobody particularly liked Catholics, but they loved their money.
The opposition.
You, sir,
name?
Boston College, Trinity Hall. The second speaker, I appreciate his witty remark that the West is characterized by secularism, and it really is an astute comment that secularism and religion don't really seem to go together. I can't really see how that is much grounds for debate. However, one of the previous House speakers raised an interesting point that 21 out of the 25 current conflicts involve Islam in some way. And he's right, that really should make us ask a question. It should ask, make us ask, why does the West have this irrational fear of Islam? Yes, I will agree that extremism is bad. Fanaticism is bad. I believe that any religion that persecutes others simply because they are different, simply because they are another religion, that should be questioned. And that's why we should probably have a debate on the Crusades. That's probably why we should have a debate on some of the parts of other Bibles. Now, the speaker for the proposition suggested that there are 15 million Jews in the world because the Jews do not proselytize, while there are a billion Muslims in the world because the Muslims do. I believe that Buddhism is one of the... I'm sorry, is my number off?
At the point of the sword,
I should say. Oh, at the point of the sword, well... I'd like to point out that there are how many Buddhists in the world? I have not met too many Buddhists proselytizing, but by the same token, this summer I met a lovely Mormon fellow. His role in his church was to organize youths to go out to Russia, to the Middle East, to Turkey, and to proselytize Mormonism. So maybe we should be up there asking, is Mormonism a threat to the East?
Extension to the motion. Yes, ma'am.
Name
and college,
please. Oh, sorry. I'm Mohini Communion, and this is the point I needed to make really early on because a lot of debate went on without discussing this, which was Islam, its beliefs as a religion, and whatever its tenets are, and Muslim countries where Muslims live, but they don't call themselves Islamic Republic or whatever. So, like, Iraq was a Baathist country, secular, socialist, when U.S. invaded Iraq. Afghanistan was not invaded because Taliban have some radical Islamist ideas. It was invaded because Taliban was supposed to be involved in 9/11. So, when you ask Indonesia to come and fight in Afghanistan, it's a political issue. What you're saying, Indonesia is again a Muslim country. It is not a Muslim country. I mean, even if there are Muslims living there, it is a country which has democracy, you know? So you really need to make the point clear about what a Muslim country, where Muslims live, probably, in a majority or minority or whatever, and what is an Islamic country where they say Islam is a religion and we are going to follow the tenets of Islam, and on the basis of that, if they do something which you do not agree with, but then you can probably raise the point. But I guess all the countries that you mentioned Turkey, again, Turkey is a democracy, it's not called itself the Islamic Republic of Turkey, so I think you're really mixing everything together, and you know, that's the point I'm making.
Thank you. Closing the case for the proposition, Mr. Arash Yassi.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you all very much for coming, first of all. We've raised many interesting points on all sides, some of which I must admit I've been struggling to follow. I'd also like to thank the honourable gentleman over there for suggesting Turkey as my next summer holiday destination. ladies and gentlemen, many of you would be surprised to see me debate on this side of the chamber, given that I, throughout my entire life, have grown up in a rather religious Muslim family. I've read the Quran first, aged 8 years old. I carry with me everywhere the Mihraj, one of the most important prayers in Islam, in my pocket every day. I've grown up with Islam ever since I was a little boy. And to top it all off, for 19 years now, I've been a citizen of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I've had the experience of knowing what Islam can do in the spiritual and personal sense, both at home, and also its impact in day-to-day political life in countries where Islam is the dominating political paradigm. Now, I've understood the stigma that goes on with Islam. I've appreciated the oppression that many people fear today. And I, too, was initially wary of debating against a religious and belief system that I've grown up with my entire life. But then eventually, as I thought this motion more and more, I realised that actually to protect the true nature of Islam, the true philosophy, some might argue, that I had no choice other than to speak for the proposition. And I'm going to go along a frame of argument which many of you may not agree with, but I hope to show you perhaps will make sense, and I hope by the end of my speech you will come onto my side of thinking and eventually vote for the proposition. Firstly, I'd like to define what I'm going to classify Islam as. We've already defined the West, and we've had many definitions, and I'm not sure there is too much controversy over that. But I'd like to define Islam as several things. Islam, first and foremost, is the religious beliefs and the philosophy that govern over a billion people in this world and their beliefs. And it would be stupid, frankly, for me to argue against that. There are so many examples where we've seen that that can potentially work peacefully. Sufism, for example, is one of the most prime examples where the true nature of Islamic philosophy on its own can work and can be integrated with today's society. And in actual fact, there are millions of Muslims all over the world who do follow Islam peacefully. And that's my second point. Islam can also be classified as the community of people who follow that religion. There is the Islamic world, for example, those who constitute or consider themselves to be Muslims. And I'm not going to, again, argue against this. And I think this motion to argue for or against that is to miss the main point in this debate. To argue against it would be to argue against millions of moderate Muslims, some of which are sitting directly opposite me and have integrated beautifully and peacefully with society. But the problem that we have, and the reason why we would even consider that to be a major problem in today's day and age, ladies and gentlemen, is because we have a mass media that whenever they are requesting the view of Muslims, tends to be dominated by one nutter who has a hook on his left hand. To be perfectly honest, you never really see these people. It's highly unlikely that my next swap at the Mahal is going to be with Cambridge University Society, Al-Qaeda Girls Drinking Society. And as fun, you know, I can't imagine that'll be particularly lively. Although, I must admit, we could probably happily go off later that night claiming to have partaken in the most intense game of Pass the Parcel. Ladies and gentlemen, I am not going to argue against the religion or the scripture, but to do so would be to argue that because Christianity 600 years ago caused so many wars and crusades, that the Bible, that Jesus, that Christians all over the world are inherent threats to the West. They are not. That is quite simply true. The reason why they were a threat 600 years ago is due to the institutions in place at the time. And it is that argument that I wish to pursue for the proposition today. I wish to argue that Islam as a political movement, as a movement which chooses to interfere with the day-to-day governing of people rather than the realms of spiritual and personal enrichment, that is the threat to the West today. I'm going to argue that Islamification, that is the phrase that I will try to use to distinguish the two, is the threat to the West today. Now, the opposition will try and argue that Islamification isn't really Islam. Islam was never really intended to impinge on the day-to-day political and governing lives of people. It was meant to enrich their personal and social lives. But I would argue, despite the fact that many of these sects we've mentioned, for example, Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia, the Taliban, the Islamic Republics of Iran say, though they do augment Islam in a way that it was not intended by the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his followers, what it still means is there are millions of people around the world who take this to be Islam, and therefore it is perfectly legitimate to consider this an aspect of Islam. Though Islamic republics in themselves perhaps are contradictory in nature, many of them go against the values of the Quran when they impinge on people's rights and sort of democratic abilities and their inherent human rights. This is, whether we wish to appreciate or not, a new radical form of Islam. It may not be an idealised form, but it is a legitimate form of Islam. I'm going to now argue, which I hope will be the easiest point in my case, is to argue how those institutions are in fact a threat to the West. This, I feel, is the most obvious point. We can recall many different aspects of the news. For example, the impingements of the rights of women, of homosexuals, of children, the lack of the expression of human rights, the impingement in many aspects on liberal democracy. For example, even in the UK, although he's not with us today, initially was planned to, the former head of the Muslim Council of Britain, Dr. Barry, advocated at one point that Britain should try to look into the possibility of using arranged marriages. This simply, I believe, is not compatible with a view of a liberal democracy that we have in this country. The whole point of liberal democracy is to enable people to separate their own views and to live their own enriched lives. And I believe, ladies and gentlemen, that religion, be it Islam, Christianity, Judaism, whatever, has no place in that statement. I believe that politicalization of religion is the inherent threat to the West, because it impinges on those values which we hold most dear by living in this country.
Sorry.
On that point, yes.
Even if I was going to accept all of your analysis as to what political Islam is, firstly, do you not think by putting it away into a box that said it's wrong, it's bad, you should hear them, will have a negative impact on people?
Thank you. I'm going to come on to that point later. This is the point that I want to address right at the very end, why we have to address that point. The other major point that I want to raise in terms of the international world is a country which many people consider to be the greatest threat to the West right now, and that is my own country, the Islamic Republic of Iran. I have seen this country, and my family immediately has seen this country transform from what was 30 years ago a very prosperous, inclusive, progressive state that within 10 years was transformed by a movement claiming to be under the facade of Islam, and therefore an Islamic Republic, into one that oppresses its people, into one that puts an illegitimate ruler to downgrade the human rights of its citizens, and one that attacks many nations verbally and threateningly across the world. And as for the argument that the proposition put before, the opposition, about how the Arab world has actually enriched society and the Western world. In actual fact, in the second invasion of the Persian Empire under the Arabs undertook huge amounts of book burning, then claiming much of Iranian civilization and discovery under their own tenure. To suggest that the Arabic world or the Islamic world was peaceful in that regard and enriched the world is, frankly, a little bit insulting that I find personal on that point. Yes.
Thank you. So
I'll say that very quickly.
Okay, yeah. But the Abbasid Empire made their prime ministers Persians. They were Persians. The Baramics in the Abbasid Empire were Persians. The Arabs recognized the...
Okay, sorry, that's wrong. I'm going to stop you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. So I've hoped I've tried to convince you that political Islam is an inherent threat to the West. Now, many of you may consider why that's an important thing. Surely if you separate political Islam from the ideals, then you don't have a problem. Well, sadly, I don't think that's true. Wahhabism, for example, prints more Qurans and influences more Islamic sects around the world than any other institution. No, thank you. And as a result, has more of an influence on what people perceive to be the true Islam. Whether we like it or not, and despite the irony of it, Islamification of the philosophy of Islam is taking place. Islamification of Muslims and the supporters of true Islam is taking place. And the problem we've had with our policies to date, ladies and gentlemen, is we've chosen to ignore these problems. We've chosen to simply accept that they are completely distant from us, thank you, that extremism is not our problem, it's a completely different group of people. But we, ladies and gentlemen, need to stop shying away from this problem and need to stop ignoring it. The Quran fundamentally states that one must obey the laws and the values of the nation with which you reside in. All this talk we've had of the oppression of people in nations because their views are not and their beliefs aren't necessarily being upheld isn't exactly true, given the Quran states you must obey the laws of that nation. If every Muslim, I tell you no, no thank you, tomorrow stood proudly and acknowledged the fact, the threat that Islamification, political Islamification, posed to Western liberal democracy, do we honestly feel that this debate would be taking place? If we saw that every Muslim today accepted that Islam as a political force was a threat to the West, irrespective of whether the religion or the followers are, I honestly do not believe we would be seeing this debate. It may be difficult, thank you. It may be hard to stomach and confusing. But I would not ask you to consider proposing this motion if you do not feel that it would be essential for the long-term health of Islam's philosophy and its followers to accept the distinction that needs to be made between the involvement of Islam in the state and the involvement of Islam into people's day-to-day lives. So, ladies and gentlemen, I urge you to vote for human rights, to vote for gender equality, for peace, progress, change. I urge you to vote for Islam's philosophy. I urge you to vote for those who follow Islam peacefully and moderately. But I beg you, ladies and gentlemen, to vote against the political nature of Islam, the political implementation of Islam. I urge you to vote against Islamification. I urge you to vote with the proposition. Thank you.
Closing the case for the opposition, Mr. Abdullah Al-Andalusi.
Hello, greetings. I'm your friendly neighbourhood Islamist. I was a bit late coming from London today, but you know, the queue of infidels to behead was rather longer than usual. Now, I guess getting to more salient points, we've heard this very interesting discussion. I think it can break it down to this. The people that came after me who were opposing the proposition, they were viewed as, or there's an allegation, these are not true Muslims, or they represent some fringe element of Islam. Well, I'm going to be a little controversial, and if anyone has seen me on video and so on, not Crime Watch, but... the debates I've had, I've debated secularism, atheism, I've trans, I have a penchant for political philosophy, and I am a convert to Islam from Portuguese descent. One contention, you shouldn't call it Islamic Spain, there is Portugal there too, call it the Iberian Peninsula. Damn Spanish. Anyway, no offense. Or maybe some. Anyway, now, essentially this, I believe in the Sharia. I believe in Orthodox Islam for 1,400 years. I believe in all the elements that all that is unpopular that you've seen. But I'd like to explain that there is a big, big misunderstanding. And I'm going to be very antisocial, but I am an Islamist after all. And I'm going to have to not take people's points because I've got a lot of things I want to refute. And the organization I was part of does a lot of debating. I'd like to make another point that last year, December the 10th, my organisation invited Stephen Gash for a debate on Islamification of Britain, myth or reality. He pulled out a few days before that. No, sorry. Sorry.
I'm not taking a point of information.
You can just afterwards. Okay. Anyway, now he said, I want to ask the points he said at the beginning. He said that the West is summed up by democracy. So whatever the people choose is correct. So, if the people choose to massacre a minority of their population, let's say the Jews, then it should be correct according to the criteria of Stephen Gash. No doubt, perhaps, this will allow him in the future to discharge some agendas that he might have against the Muslim population, another Semitic religion, which is with the same kind of law system. In fact, virtually an identical law system to the Jewish faith. Also, they said that women only got the vote 100 years ago, while in Islam, 1,400 years ago, the Prophet Muhammad requested the Pledge of Allegiance from women and men, and that's in the text. Also, the other point is Saudi Arabia is an Islamic state. Are you kidding me? It is a monarchy. And as a monarchy, everyone knows that interest banking is forbidden in Islam, but yet Saudi Arabia has interest banking. It applies the Sharia for stealing on poor people, of which Islam says, and there is strict hadith on this, that if a person is poor, you can't punish them for stealing. It is the fault of the state. They should have provided. But in Saudi Arabia, they punish all the poor people, and the rich Saudi royal family go away for free. They don't get touched. They have legal immunity. That is not Islam. The only state that you can see which would be Islamic is a caliphate. The caliphate is the Islamic model. There is no caliphate for 80 years. So we can't say, oh, which model of state is Islamic. And even the Shias believe in a caliphate state, although they have different criteria as who can be that caliph. Iran is a model based on Plato's Republic, with the philosopher ruler, with Ayatollah Khomeini fancying himself as the philosopher who knows better, Walayat al-Mutlaqa, as they call it. And it also has the same structure as the British system, with two houses of parliament and, of course, a supreme leader, although I don't think the Queen issues fatwas anymore. These are that Islam doesn't give Muslims rights. Well, I like to quote, let's deal in text. Let's not deal with what I say. According to Stephen Gash, I'm a lying Muslim. So, I'm going to deal... Yeah, there he goes. So, reminds me of that excerpt from the film Kingdom of Heaven. That's a Saracen. He lies. Anyway, the Prophet Muhammad said, in the book of Hadiths, he said that whoever oppresses a person who is under covenant, a non-Muslim, in living in Islamic State, or oppresses him, or imposes on him something more than he can afford, or humiliates him, or takes anything from him without his consent, I will oppose him on the Day of Judgment. The Prophet Muhammad also said that anyone that harms a dhimmi has harmed me. Yeah? And the word dhimmi means a person under contract. It is no different to the Rousseauian citizen contract, whereby the state is under contract with a citizen to provide minimum protection. Now I'm totally happy to debate this entire subject on what the text actually says, including when the sacred months have passed, killed infidels, wherever you find them. Let's quote the entire surah. The entire surah says about those polytheists who were in an alliance, or not alliance, an agreement with the Muslims for a neutral non-aggression. They broke the agreement. So what did the Quran reveal? It said, when the months are over, or this agreement, when it's over, then attack these people. But the Prophet Muhammad also said that you don't attack the women, the children, and the man who's tilling the lawn. This is a text. I'm sorry, my friend. We live in a free state where you can express. Do not impinge upon my freedom to express myself. Okay. He says, why don't we see Muslims challenging these extremists that come on media, on TV and so on? We held a debate. We invited the BNP to criticize Islam on a public platform, much to the UAF's disgruntlement with this. And we begged all the media organizations, come see Muslims giving a free platform to the BNP, our most ardent detractors. I'm talking about the BNP.
Yes, we're talking about the BNP.
Anyway, we begged the BBC, Channel 4, we begged ITV, we begged every media outlet we could find to come cover this. We'll show you Muslims supporting free speech. It wasn't newsworthy, they said. Wasn't newsworthy. But Andrew Chalmers spouts his mouth. Oh, suddenly they're at his front door. He's got MI5 on speed dial, according to what he admitted in public. Isn't it funny? MI5 providing him protection. Why? Because he is the darling of the media. He gives a sensationalism that makes you want to buy a newspaper, a Daily Mail or the Sun or whatever. Right? And this is the problem, that we Muslims who did our best to try to display an action showing that we support open debate, which is an Islamic concept, by the way. This was not allowed to be shown by the media. And that's why you don't see Muslims opposing Anand Chowdhury, because the media will not show you this to you.
Sit down!
So,
Mr. Gash.
I'm talking about the BNP. Are you got conscious?
Yeah.
All right.
Excuse me, Mr. Gash, he has the floor. Please respect our rules. If not, we have to escort you out. So please, I understand. Please. Everyone has gotten 10 minutes to speak. It is now Mr. Al-Andalusi's chance to speak. He has 10 minutes to speak. Please respect us. I understand how you feel, but again, we run by rules. This is a debating society. Please adhere to the rules. Thank you.
Okay. Anyway.
In Spanish, it's a racist. Get him out.
Thank you,
no. The threat to the West.
That's next week's debate. Anyway. Now on to secularism. You know, is religion a threat to secularism? I'll tell you this. I think secularism does not...
Terrible!
Okay.
This is supposed to be a country of free speech.
Excuse me. We have rules. Mr. Gash was informed of those rules. We have to follow this. This is what democracy is about. This is what freedom is about. Mr. Al-Andalusi has the floor. He's entitled to complete his statement and to take any points of information that he deigns to accept or to reject. Please respect those rights. I know this is a contentious debate, but again, we're not going to finish this debate on time unless we adhere to these rules and respect one another. Mr. Al-Andalusi, again, please continue.
Thank you. Sorry. No, I wish he'd come back in. I was silent when he was speaking, and I wanted to use this point in time to rebut. And of course, you know, there's so much to discuss. But secularism itself, very interesting enough, and anyone who reads the history of secularism, borrowed some main proponents of its social theories from religion. It depended on religion for the issue of equality. Equality was defined or came from a Judeo-Christian tradition. That how are we all equal? We are all matter or human beings or so on. Fine, but some human beings are more intelligent than others. Some are stronger than others. Some come from more wealthy families or have better genes or what have you. Yeah, Plato in his Republic says continually that we're not equal. Human beings are not equal. And so right, I love that point.
Regardless of the source of secularism, right? It is a truism that secularism and religion are incompatible, as we've heard.
Hold it. But if secularism depends on religion to give it its values, then secularism is vacuous and empty without religion. Also, free will. Sorry, free will. Free will. Where does this concept come from? If you are a materialist, you're more likely to believe in a determinist universe, not in a capacity for some intrinsic capacity of human beings to have a free will, undetermined by external environmental or genetic factors. Also, a morality system, which, let's face it, I think across the board, every historian admits that was borrowed from Christianity. In fact, John Locke and many of these people were Christians. John Locke was a practicing Christian, a very devout religious one, and he even wrote a book on the reasonableness of Christianity. John Locke, it's a true point. What does rationality bring you, devoid of religion? You get utilitarianism. Bentham and Mill both discussed how it was justified for imperialism of the kind of lesser civilized peoples of the world. Yeah, you can read it. This is the white man's burden, as it was called. Now, this is what secularism needs religion to rein it back its materialistic tendencies. Nationalism has caused more wars and more death and suffering in the last 100 years than religion has in the last 500 years. Nationalism is the new sectarian divide. Well, why is it that a human being for example, Maggie McCann, she a blonde-haired, blue-eyed woman, why is it that she was more important than the hundreds of dead Iraqi female children and so on? That is, no. It is nationalism that separates us from looking at each other as one holistic humanity. Nationalism is the true threat. And if you were to say that the West is based only on nationalism, then maybe Islam is against the West. But it is not, because I've seen in the West, and I've read from the political philosophers of the West, a desire to improve humanity. We shall not be stuck on any one particular dogma that the West currently adopts, and now we have to preserve it against the tide of change. The West has always been about change. We should embrace change. I'm not saying to establish Sharia in the UK. In fact, I would say that the in Islam, as Muslims, our duty is to be, our main duty to spread Islam is to be models of justice. The best way for me to spread Islam to you guys is that I go to the Muslim countries and make our countries a model of justice such that you see that we are an enlightened and civilized nation and civilization. And this is the point. I will say this, that the West itself is not even entirely secular. If you go to the National Secular Society website, you see them constantly bemoaning how unsecular the West is. In fact, I doubt you can find a country in the West that secularists are totally happy with. So in that sense, if the West is not even entirely secular, then where is this secularism that is an enemy to religion that is causing Islam to be a threat to the West in the first place? Doesn't exist. All right. Also, I think finally, to kind of wrap up my point, what you do see in the world is what was stated. This, all this terrorism, all these actions that you're seeing, you see stated by the people, these extreme nutters like Osama bin Laden. Thank you. You see by the CIA themselves, the heads of CIA reported this, but the main factor, the main factor, or almost the sole determining factor of terrorism occurring in the West is foreign policy and not ideology. In fact, Osama bin Laden himself said that he doesn't care about Western freedoms. He cares about the Western designs in the Muslim world, the supporting of various regimes like Saudi Arabia. Osama bin Laden is upset with America for supporting the dictatorship of Saudi Arabia. Now, Osama bin Laden's methodology is incorrect because he advocates killing human beings. Right? But wait. But I would say that Osama bin Laden is a bigger believer in democracy than us. Do you know why? Because Osama bin Laden truly believes that the government of the West that does these attacks and bombings and killings of civilians truly represents you guys. So he blames you guys. But we all know better. We all know that governments in the West, unfortunately, are not fully democratic. They don't represent the peoples. And that we are unfortunately dragged into wars not of our own choosing. And I'll lastly say that if you vote for the proposition, if you vote for people like Stephen Gash and the other people who discuss their points, you are supporting nothing different than just Captain Ahab's Moby Dick in the search for an enemy in his troubled times. Thank you.
Thank you for attending this very controversial, very contentious debate. As you can see, there is a lot to cover this evening. And if you could, before we end the debate, I just want to have our entertainment officer put out a few brief announcements. Before I do, first, thank you again for coming. And Abid, you have the floor.
Hi guys, just a couple of quick announcements. Tomorrow night we have an open mic night. We've got a late start at 10 o'clock, so you guys can go see the fireworks and come back. And Saturday night we have a silent disco in the chamber. Come on.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. Eyes through that door, nose through the other, abstentions down the middle. Have a good night.